Pablo Picasso once said, "There is no abstract art. You must always start with something. Afterward, you can remove all traces of reality." That seems like a fitting thing to say before we have today's episode of Conspiracy Clearinghouse. Maybe you've walked into a museum or a gallery and you've seen up on the wall a big blank white canvas or a big circle and you've thought, huh, so that's art, is it? Or maybe it spoke to you, it evoked something in you. But why is there so much of this stuff out there? Well, the answer is a little bit surprising. And it has to do with the Cold War and the CIA. To help me in this, since I don't know that much about it myself, I am talking to Mandy Tice. She is the founder and director of the School of Atelier Arts and the academic director and a professor at the Florence Academy of Art. That's Florence, Italy, folks. Thank you for joining me today, madam.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a delight to be here.
And thank you, everybody out there, for listening to this episode of Conspiracy Clearinghouse. I remind you again that you can subscribe. So just do it. Yeah. And you can review us on IMDb. Somebody should do that as well. That would be nice. And if you like what we do, you can buy us a coffee via our Buy Me a Coffee page. You leave the world behind and enter a large chamber, filled with boxes and crates as far as the eye can see. Welcome to the Conspiracy Clearinghouse. The podcast that takes a rather skeptical look at conspiracies and mysteries. Each episode will examine various conspiracy theories, most of which are not true, a few of which might be a little bit true, and even a couple that turned out, in fact, to be true. There are many boxes in the clearinghouse, and along the way, we'll look at some mysteries and hoaxes as well. We dare to look behind the curtain that's behind the curtain. I'm your host, Derek DeWitt. Welcome to the Conspiracy Clearinghouse. Mandy, the School of Atelier Arts, what is that? What is it that you guys are doing?
So the School of Atelier Arts is a school, obviously, about art. We teach art, and we teach a very specific kind of art. So when you hear the word atelier, atelier is the French word for studio. And in contemporary settings, what it means is you're painting realistically. So if you've ever wanted to be able to draw or paint exactly what you see in a very realistic way, if you've ever been to a museum and you wondered, how did they do that? How did they make this look so real? Atelier training is what you're after. And so our school, we teach atelier classes online and through workshops, and we help people learn how to draw and paint realistically.
Absolutely apropos for what we're about to talk about, since we're going to talk about basically how more abstract fine art forms kind of came to the fore in the during the years of the Cold War. So it's interesting that that's your thing is realistic. I'm guessing mainly figurative.
Yes, so very figurative. But you know, landscape work, portrait, figure. There are still people that make their living painting portraits. You know, so it's just that these skills fell out of favor in large part because of the ascendancy of, you know, abstraction and other what's considered contemporary art skills. And that's made it really, really hard to still learn these old school skills. They nearly went extinct by the 1980s. And today, ironically, they're the countercultural movement in art.
Right. Isn't that funny? Well, what was old is new again, I guess, is the old saying, right?
Yeah. Indeed.
I mean, the context for all this stuff go way, way back. But we're going to start really with the beginning of the Cold War. And that means World War II is over. Japan and Germany and Italy before have been defeated. The Axis is in trouble. America says we're going to be smart this time. Like after World War I, we didn't really help people out economically, and that gave rise to World War II. So they come up with the Marshall Plan, and they have all this money that they're going to give countries to help them rebuild so that we don't have more, you know, crazy people taking over and of a totalitarian bent, finding ways to manipulate the populace into voting them into office. And then, ha ha, you can't vote me out. It's the old saying, you know, you can vote yourself into a dictatorship. Trouble is, you just can't vote yourself out, you know. But the OSS and a lot of the sort of secretive type stuff that was going on during the war, for example, I did a previous episode about the Ghost Army and the beach jumpers and all these sort of ways of manipulating the fog of war so that the enemy is confused and doesn't know what to do and, you know, wastes time and resources. Link in the episode notes if you want to hear about that. But all of that stuff was so successful that they said, well, let's create this new thing called the Central Intelligence Agency, the CIA. A lot of the guys in there at the top in the very beginning, they had always been suspicious of Stalin and communism. They grew up, probably their, you know, fathers and grandfathers were probably very active on the aggressive side of the Red Scare of the 1920s. They had always felt that the USSR being an ally during World War II was never really going to last. And so they were like, these guys, these communists are a big problem, and immediately started to figure out ways to sort of counterbalance what the Soviets were up to.
Yes, indeed. And certainly it's important to note that the early individuals involved in particularly the art side of the scheming of the CIA and its earlier manifestations were highly educated, kind of elitist, you know, Ivy League school grads, old boys club kind of people. And they had very clear ideas of what they thought was good and what they thought was bad. And they basically had an unregulated agency in which to execute those ideas.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. They have very little oversight. These guys, many of whom were, I mean, a lot of hard drinking, hard living guys, very much in the old boys school, like you said, they come from money. And many of them have a very elitist attitude towards the world. I call it a Roman idea that they're the rulers.
Very patrician. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. They're the plebs. And then there are the people who should rule. And you think, well, why should you rule? It's because we have money. How did you get it? My father gave it to me, you know.
God willed it.
Yeah, exactly. I thought we got rid of this with the English. I guess not, you know. And a lot of these guys are more than a little bit nuts. They kind of, very early on in the sort of conflict that became known as the Cold War, we think of the Cold War as spies and stealing weapons plans and that guy's, you know, trying to cozy up to this politician's wife, so we kill them in a back alley. And yes, that did happen, but actually a good deal of it was in fact cultural.
Oh, indeed. In fact, did you know that Julia Child's husband, who worked for the State Department, he was very involved with this, like putting shows together, you know, under this new movement, under this new direction that was being pushed by the CIA. So even though the State Department was separate from that, if you read the biography that Julia Childs wrote about her time in France, she straight up calls work propaganda. It's openly propaganda. And, you know, they know it. She knows it. He knows it. The agency knows it, but they are doing it on behalf of America in their mindset.
Right. Like, so I read that book at your suggestion, The Cultural Cold War by Francis Stoner Saunders. And there are quotes in there from some of these people who were tasked with basically not only forming the CIA, but deciding what its brief is. They kind of just went, I guess it's this, you know, very much in reaction to what the Soviets were already doing. The Soviets had always thought, hey, we have our way of doing things. We are going to have writers who push our ideas, because in our minds, this is a war of ideas, and we're trying to basically fight for the minds and thus the souls of humanity, / I hope I can get a bigger apartment, you know, and the CIA guys did the same thing, you know?
Yes. You know, what's interesting about that, you know, it was the time that they started, realism was no longer realism. It became communist realism, right? And that was a brand that, you know, was associated with the shift in this direction that the United States was pushing. You know, I happen to know a little bit about 20th century Russian realism. A colleague of mine was the director of the museum in Utah that has one of the largest collections of 20th century Russian realism in the world. He like collected it, you know, for 20 years in this tiny little museum just outside of Salt Lake City. Touring the museum with him is just astonishing, because he had these fabulous stories of the Russians. So for example, cadmium red was an expensive pigment, right? But if you were a state-sanctioned Russian artist, your paint was paid for. And this artist needed to paint his house, but getting house paint was really difficult. And kind of out of spite, he painted his entire house cadmium red because he could get the free red as an official sanctioned painter, right?
Wow. See, that's what I love. I love those little ways to kind of like, the Slavs who lived under communism, even today, they are very good at following the letter, but not the spirit of the rules, you know?
Yes. Well, you know, I think it's interesting just aesthetically, but, you know, when you look in that museum, you'll see like there's a technique called like dry brushing where you let your paint, you know, dry up a little bit and then you can like really slab on thick layers, you know, of paint, you know, because it's more tacky and sticky. And you'll see like soldiers with sashes that are like an inch thick of paint just because they could. And you would never, ever, ever see that in Western art because the finances behind it were very different, right?
Yeah, that's for sure. Yeah, paint costs money, buddy.
When, you know, you have options for paint, then paint choices become broader, right? Whereas when I was in atelier training, so atelier training is like 3 to 4 years of full-time training intensive. You only draw for like a year and then you paint in a limited palette, maybe only black and white for a year, and then maybe just like three colors for a year and then finally full color. But everybody in school is painting like the thinnest they possibly can because they're all poor, right? They're like trying to save their paint and they're mixing, you know, the tiniest dabs of paint. And, you know, we don't think about how these things affect, you know, how your style evolves or, you know, how you lay down your paint or your paint handling skills, but they really do. If you go into any atelier, you'll see very thin layers of paint. And then as artists become more established, you'll see them, you know, using paint a little bit more liberally. You know, practice makes permanent. And this is part of the problem with the CIA pushing these skillless types of art. And by skillless, I mean, okay, here's a white canvas or I'm dripping paint. Like you can drip paint, I can drip paint. That in it alone is not a skill. Marketing it is a skill. But when we stopped practicing the skills, they quickly fell out of favor. And today there's maybe a few thousand people in the world that can actually paint at a technical level of what you saw 100 years ago. It's crazy.
So the Soviets had come up with this thing that's known as social realism, which I quite like, I have to be honest. I'm a little bit of a fan of it. It's obviously taking these ideas of modernism, which is at a deco, you know. My interests are much more in the realms of architecture, but, you know, a Czech guy, actually, Alfons Mucha, living in Paris, is one of the people who sort of came up with Art Nouveau, which was very lovely and sort of ornate and used a lot of natural motifs. And then there are reactions against that. Another, in the Czech lands, in Moravia, we have functionalism. In Germany, they had Bauhaus, which was, hey, let's strip away these ornate things and let's just focus on the function of the structure that we're building. Bauhaus was deemed by Hitler to be a decadent and degenerate architectural style. So it kind of got put on hold and the Czechs kind of got a chance to play around with it. And they come up with architectural cubism, which you also find in Paris. And they have a very weird style that today is known as Rondo cubism, which is the only place in the world that you can find it. It's this kind of weird rounded cubist stuff, you know.
Well, you know, you make some really important points here about how it's in motion, right? That's art is in motion. So Russia did not necessarily come up with realism or social realism. They actually, when they started their training, their ateliers that they started there, they sent people to France, took some of the French instructors, brought them back under Catherine the Great, right? And then kind of bifurcated from there, you know, into by the 20th century, you know, the Russians were working much more from imagination than other European schools. You know, Impressionism was the ultimate. If I look at something, how do I actually create exactly what I'm seeing? It was like the ultimate in visual realism, whereas the Russians were interested in storytelling more and, you know, created systems for drawing and painting realistically from imagination. And so, you know, by the time, you know, Russia's well into the 20th century, you know, you have social realism because the state was directing to some degree what the artists were allowed or not allowed to paint about. But the same thing happened in the United States. And that's the part that people don't realize, right? So simply by the CIA over promoting Jackson Pollock, for example, over artists that would have been considered great painters that got, you know, relegated to illustration, Norman Rockwell, right? Like, he would have been considered a great painter 50 years before, but because he was in the midst of, you know, the Cold War, it wasn't okay to be a realist painter. So as long as he was an illustrator, it was okay, right?
Yeah, well, that's for sure. So what we're talking about is how this kind of all comes to a head. Basically, these it's a war of aesthetics in some ways, but it's also a war of marketing between the Soviet bloc and the Western bloc, and the Communist bloc is obviously led by the USSR, and the USA is clearly leading the charge on the Western side because Europe is so busy going, another war. Oh my God, we don't have any men left, you know.
Right, they're recovering, and you know that was another reason that the training atelier training really fell out of favor, is because before World War One and World War Two, and even in between the two wars, Americans were still going to Paris to get the training. But by the time World War II ended, like, everybody who had that knowledge had died in the war, was demoralized, had to do something else. Like, you know, the systems that were supporting those art schools at the level that they had previously been teaching had been demolished along with many other things in the war. But the Americans that had the training from like the 1850s up until the collapse of the Parisian school, Americans also trained in Germany because there were a lot of German immigrants, but same thing, right? Same problems with continuing that trend. So, you know, there were a few pockets. There was the Cincinnati Art School, there was the Boston School, you know, there was the Art Students League of New York, you know, that had pockets of this training and to varying degrees of the training and were able to hold on to the training for various degrees. And also when the CIA was promoting, you know, this modern, quote unquote, modern art over realist art, a lot of the realist artists went into illustration or they went into California to work in the movies, right? And that's why you see some really beautiful, impressive visual aesthetics in the movies, is because they were translating this atelier knowledge to that new visual format.
Oh, sure. I mean, I would imagine that some of those people went on to become matte painters and all the rest, which now people don't know. We don't use these anymore. We use computers. But like Ralph McQuarrie is one of the great matte painters of all time. And he had these, he basically did all these background paintings, very realistic looking for, you know, Star Wars and all these films that Lucasfilm and ILM were involved with. And he'd been doing this for, you know, decades and decades and decades. And yeah, that's very much true. So the Soviets basically say, okay, we're going to go social realism. That's our thing. And a lot of people also have to keep in mind that in post-war France, there were still people who, before the war, had been sympathetic towards the ideas of communism and Marxism, and nobody really knew that Stalin was just such a colossal monster. And so when words are, did you know, he's creating these forced famines and these, you know, work camps and relocating whole populations and a wholesale slaughter of his own people. They didn't believe him. Like Jean-Paul Sartre, he didn't believe any of this stuff. And he was still in Paris. He's the guy. And he and Camus both had the attitude of, well, the Americans, you know, they're technical people, they're engineers, they're technicians. They don't have anything to say as far as the arts. Their literature is childish. Their figurative art is childish. And so the CIA is suddenly finding itself like, oh, we're fighting for the hearts and minds of humanity. How do we change the French people's minds about us? Because where France goes, Europe kind of goes at this point.
But frankly, the CIA and the precursors to the CIA, because this started, you know, before the official formation of the CIA, they did it with money. They did it in the most American way possible, because they just flooded the culture of France and other, you know, Western countries. There was so much resistance to abstract expressionism in Europe. Like, if you read the journals or, you know, the response to abstract expressionism, especially of the early exhibits, it is like very undesired. But because there's so much money coming in from the Marshall Plan, nobody's going to be like, you can't put it there. Right. And so it's like they got their foot in the door. Like, France universally hated abstract. I shouldn't say universally, probably some people did, but they didn't want it. They didn't like it. If you read like kind of the response to it at the time that it was introduced. It was very not wanted, but it was literally forced into the highest circles, right? So we're not talking just, oh, they put on a show, maybe come or maybe don't. It was, oh, you want this money from the Marshall Plan? You better come to this art opening, right? Okay, Mr. Mayor.
Right, we better see you there. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Okay, tastemaker. Okay, fashion designer. There was so much coercion subtly done through money and not so nefariously. Like, I'm sure they weren't saying directly, we're not going to give you this money if you don't come. But the money was flowing. And if you wanted a piece, you played ball, right?
Right, and I'll show up for an evening and look at a bunch of art I don't like. I mean, and then my school gets funded for another year. Not such a big deal, I guess.
Yeah, exactly.
So this Marshall Plan money, which in theory was supposed to go towards helping these countries rebuild their infrastructure and their economies, a lot of that money instead is just kind of going into a bag. And these early CIA guys are just taking out whatever they want. They're like, "Hey, let's create this thing in 1950 called the Congress for Cultural Freedom."
Yes, which they laundered so much money through.
So much money through, and then they're going to other people, writers and artists, and like you said, tastemakers, and going, "Hey, this is kind of what we're trying to do. We're trying to counter the." Because the Soviets are very much trying to get into the French head of saying, right, the Americans suck and we don't. And so, therefore, maybe you might be more open to our ideas on how we should structure society as well. That was the hope.
Yeah, it's not so different from a social media buy today, right? Like how effective it is when a country buys a lot of social media exposure for a particular topic. It is effective because as much as we like to think that we're independent thinkers, like we know that the more we're exposed to something, the more likely we are to believe it. And so it was like the 1950s, 60s, 70s equivalent of social media buy. Like, okay, we're just going to keep putting this in front of people, putting this in front of people. And not only that, but the Congress of Cultural Freedom, which was a CIA front, they were the ones that were paying Clement Greenberg, the so-called great New York Times art critic, right? Like that's not a coincidence. Like there was an agenda that was pushed. They found someone to be the mouthpiece for it, and then they gave him the veneer of the New York Times to further, gild that credential. But it was totally arbitrary what he would support or what he wouldn't, like what movements would get picked up, and then his rivalry with fellow art critics, also often paid by the CIA, and also the plants that they were putting on the board to make sure that the artists that they were pushing for were being given retrospectives at the MoMA and things like that. They infiltrated the Ford Foundation, sometimes knowingly with the founder's knowledge and sometimes unknowingly. And we still don't know which one was which, but every major arts organization, that we think of that is branded in the US, like the Museum of Modern Art, the MoMA, the Congress of Cultural Freedom, the New York Times art critic, all of these layers of veneer that give quote unquote authenticity to an idea were completely controlled to some degree to push an agenda that was decided by the central figures that were running their propaganda campaign.
So the social realism, America sucks, that's coming from one side. And everybody's kind of going for, like, conservatives are conservatives and they're never going to go communist or not. But they're kind of going for what was known by the CIA people as the NCLs or the non-communist left. People who are left wing, who might be fence sitters, and we want to pull them over to our side and have them help us in our efforts to say, no, the West is the best and America is the best of the West. And so that's what we want you to do. And also that will open up more business opportunities and so on. So they look at this abstract expressionism, this art form or art method or style that kind of shows up coming out of sort of a blender of surrealism and Dada and Cubism and the stuff that Matisse did and all of this modernist stuff. And like you mentioned, Jackson Pollock, he's the one I always think of when I think of abstract expressionism. That's him.
And he would be nothing without the CIA. Like, of all the artists, abstract expressionism was particularly picked up by the CIA as what they wanted to push, and he was the head of it. And also, it should be noted that he was an enormous asshole.
He was, but he was this kind of classic guy's guy. He's almost like a John Wayne. He's a hard drinker. He's a womanizer. Yes, he...
beating his wife, hard drinking.
Yeah, he's certainly not good for a Me Too world. But he's this kind of like, he's like a dude. He's like Bluto in the Popeye cartoons, kind of. But he's also smart.
He was a great marketer, which is why he was so effective at what he did and why, you know, it was such a synergy with the CIA sending him on these international exhibits as a relatively unknown artist, right? But the CIA kind of picked abstract expressionism in particular, not exclusively. They had other pet, you know, isms that they were dealing with. But I think it's really important to note, and I wish I had made a note. So in the book, The Cultural Cold War, the author talks about how, you know, all these abstract expressionism artists were originally picked up and sent on these international exhibits. But then one of them attended the protests in the South for ending segregation. And guess who got dropped? And we don't know whose name even today. I'm struggling to remember his name, right?
Wow, isn't that funny? Blacklisted. This is Blacklist before Blacklist, or right around the same time as the Blacklist.
Right, right. Because he had dared, you know, to be a part of the civil rights movement. And it's really important to note that a big part of the resistance in Europe in the Cold War was that, you know, with all the diverse soldiers that America sent to Europe, there became a much greater understanding in Europe of the segregation in America and just how horrifically America was treating particularly Black people in the United States. And so there was a lot of resistance the CIA was trying to overcome, showing that, oh, you know, separate but equal is great. You just don't know, right?
Right, right. You should try it.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, just horrific human rights violations, you know, going on. And the Europeans were like, oh, you're trying to tell us that your way is free and this is how you treat people in your own country. And we know these soldiers now. They fought for us. They helped us. You know, they helped liberate us. And you treat them like this back home. Like,
right. Simply because of their skin color, you know, like, God, that just seems for people like, you know, Jean-Paul Sartre, who are living at this, let's say, at a higher plane, thinking about big thoughts. That just seems like, that's just so weird and petty. What is wrong with you guys? And by doing that, he's also ignoring centuries of French colonialism. So, you know.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. It's a complex issue that's worth sorting out and understanding, for sure.
I remember reading when the Congress of Cultural Freedom is coming up with these big shows, like we're going to do a whole bunch of modern composers and music, not jazz, you know, quote unquote classical, but American stuff. And now we're going to start doing art exhibits and we're going to tour them around and start pushing like, no, America, look, you know, we're not begging for attention like a little brother that's been ignored for years, but we kind of are a little bit.
They wanted the European stamp of approval because, you know, New York City could become the center of the art world if they could get Europe on board. And can we just stop and take a minute to talk about the Congress of Cultural Freedom as a title and how completely absurd that is.
It's very Soviet sounding.
And cultural freedom, like, at least the Russians knew they were being manipulated by their government and that the government was controlling their art. And in the United States, that was not the case. Most people don't understand the amount of, you know, interference that the U.S. government, you know, had in the evolution of the arts in the last 50 years in this country. So it's a cultural freedom by, oh, we'll dictate what the taste is and then impose it on people. But that's real American freedom. They just don't know what they like yet.
Yeah. So here comes this this thing, and you still hear people today go like, oh, it's a big circle on a canvas. My kid can do that, or that's just splatter, paint splatter. What is this Pollock guy?
They can. They are absolutely right. They can do that.
Well, that's perhaps a conversation we'll have in a bit. But because like the Picasso quote says, I mean, you did start with nothing. I mean, you had to decide what kind of a canvas are we going to use? How big is it going to be? What's the shape going to be? Do I want this? Like, you know, when people who ended up pushing this as this abstract expressionism as this is a truly American art form that has come up sort of naturally, except that yes, it maybe would have been a footnote in history had the CIA not decided, no, this is our flagship brand. This is what we're pushing.
Because they decided it didn't mean anything, right? Like when they were looking at the other artworks, they're like, oh, this could be communist or this, but that one was safe, right? Like they knew that it wasn't saying anything about communism to anybody, right?
Right. Well, that was one of the things, is that it was a line I came across somewhere was that it was politically neutral. Some people felt it was, it's just childish dribblings. But others were like, no, it's energy. It's intention freed from the constraints of form. It's emotion. It's confrontational. It's flow.
It's governmental in my mind, because even today, if you are on any board, I'm involved in various boards, and there's an art, somebody wants to put a new statue or replace a statue, which is a topic of conversation in the States right now. Most frequently, statues are being replaced by abstraction, right? Because there's nobody to protest it, right? If you put a sculpture of a woman, it's like, why is it a woman? If you put a sculpture of, a tree, well, why is it that tree or not this tree? Or
right. Fans of the larch are in an uproar because you put an oak.
Right. But the point is that anytime that there's groupthink about what art is public art, the safest choice is art that doesn't say anything and that doesn't mean anything. And that's why you see so many, like the giant bean in Chicago that they love so much. Like it's so not saying anything. It's so not controversial. And I don't care what veneer they put on it to make it, a big, deep, meaningful piece of artwork. It's nothing, right? It's not saying anything. It's not offending anybody. It's safe. So abstract art, in my opinion, especially abstract art that's publicly commissioned, is the safest of all the art. And I also want to go back to what Picasso, because people don't realize Picasso was classically trained. Picasso had the vestiges of Atelier training before it collapsed, because Picasso's father trained at the École des Beaux-Arts. And Picasso's father started training him with the École des Beaux-Arts training from a very young age. We have Barg plates, which is one of the first projects you do in an atelier, that he did when he was 12, that are currently mislabeled in the Prado because they don't even know what they are, even though they're obviously Barg plates and easy to prove. And they're mislabeled as cast drawings in the Prado, because atelier training is so lost that even these quote unquote experts running the Prado Museum don't understand that Picasso had atelier training.
Now, of course, it maybe wasn't going to be abstract expressionism. It could have been something else that they had found. I know that Truman, when he was president, he loathed modern art. He called those artists, quote, frustrated ham and egg men, which I don't really know what the hell that means, but I like it.
Yeah. That's a great quote. I'm going to start using that.
Yeah, ham and egg men. And then talk about the conspiracy mindset. There was a congressional representative from Missouri, George Dondero, who took it a bit further. He literally thought all of these modernist art forms were, in fact, communist infiltrations into the American zeitgeist in the American art scene. He said, these are quotes by him. All modern art, he said, is destructive. Cubism destroys by disorder. Futurism by the machine myth. Dadaism by ridiculing things. So I guess you're never supposed to ridicule things in the land of the free. Expressionism by aping the primitive and the insane, which means he didn't understand it. And abstractionism, this is my favorite one, and abstractionism destroys by the creation of brainstorms. I don't understand what happened to him when he looked at abstract art. And he said, and surrealism destroys by denying reason. So here is a guy who sounds like he was a lot of fun at parties. Real stick up the butt guy, like bum ba bum ba bum. I like a picture of an orange that looks like an orange, damn it. But he really, like he was pre-McCarthy, he would become famous for ranting on the floor of the Congress about how, it's evil, and it's not just that, but these guys are communist plants, and inside these shapes and so on that they're doing, they're hiding like blueprints to the Hoover Dam.
Right. I really need to respond to this, because on one hand, a lot of people that look at people like me who are supporting atelier training, they're like, oh, you're just trying to take us back to what we were. But I really think that atelier training is about giving choice, right? I believe that artists should be able to create any artwork that they want. And part of that is knowing what's already known in art. So like learning the skills that you need. If you want to paint a white canvas, you don't need any special skill to do that. If you want to paint a pony flying through the clouds, you actually need a fair amount of technical knowledge in order to do that. And instead of reinventing the wheel every generation, which we've been doing since the 1940s, we actually have thousands of years of inherited artistic knowledge. And if you bother to get that training, then you can pick your hammer and use your hammer if you need it, or your nail. It's like having a toolbox, right? And so I don't believe that realism is trying to take art back. But often when people promote realism, they get accused of this extreme that you're talking about with the representative, George Dondero. But I also agree, not with everything that Dondero is saying here, but we did lose knowledge, and knowledge was destroyed by the excessive promotion of abstraction because the technical skills were lost. I hear this endlessly. You know, Americans, like, they'll go to Europe, you know, and they'll come back and be like, Mandy, like, it was amazing. Like, every building just felt so good to me, right? It was just so beautiful in a way I couldn't explain. And if you look at buildings being built in America today, they are box after box after box. They're ugly. They're not very functional. They have no light. Like, they're atrocious. And even if we wanted to build a beautiful building like we were doing in the 1920s or 30s, when Americans really came into their own and were developing their own style after getting their training, atelier training abroad, like, if you wanted to build a beautiful building, if you were setting out today to build a beautiful building, you would not be able to do it. You don't have architects that have the drawing training needed. You don't have craftspeople who have the nuanced carving skills to do it. So in a lot of ways, as much as I hate to admit it, because this guy is clearly like an extremist, he was right that something was being destroyed, and it was knowledge that was being destroyed. And I think that anybody that wants to paint abstract should paint abstract, and anybody who wants to paint in realism should paint in realism. But right now, realism is not even a choice because we have destroyed the knowledge. And I just think that's such a tragedy.
So the CIA decides this is their baby. This is their flagship product, cultural product. So they start promoting so much of it so quickly, by the way. It becomes so blanketed all over, not just the American cultural scene, but by extension into Europe, trying to convince people in Europe who go, what is this stuff? Instead, hey, no, maybe this does have value. Maybe it is interesting. And to go from Truman, who says these people are frustrated ham and egg men, to just one president later, Eisenhower, said modern art, especially these modern abstract styles, were, quote, a pillar of liberty. Just one president, right? And to me, it's very striking that it's really, I'm going to go back to Deep Throat, you know, when he's talking to Woodward in the parking garage in Virginia, follow the money. It's almost like because the CIA guys, I think a lot of the guys who were pushing this weren't necessarily art people. And so they're just like money, 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 money talks. And that's how it goes. And with Marshall Plan money.
Yeah, there's a reason the French viewed Americans as uncouth and unaesthetic. Right. It's because we were largely like very few Americans, only the ones that had gone abroad, you know, to train had inherited those skills, you know, or, you know, small pockets in America were starting to grow with what the Europeans believed were aesthetic skills. So we were a very aesthetically young culture, you know, in their eyes. You know, we're talking about the succession of presidents. Kennedy, when you get to Kennedy, he actually commissioned one of the last painters from Florence, Pietro Annigoni, to paint his portrait, because he was one of the last realism painters that had the skills that was mainstream enough to be found, right? So you have this flip-flop, but then Kennedy refused to actually sit for a proper portrait, and Annigoni had so many regrets about painting his portrait because it was a kind of a smear and ended up being a more abstract portrait than he would have ever wanted to paint, and felt that it wasn't doing his skills justice. He hated that he had made that painting, and then I think Time Magazine put it on their cover. He hated it because Kennedy wouldn't sit properly for a portrait, and he wouldn't work from a photograph, right? Because any realist artist that has atelier training largely is going to issue photographs. There's exceptions, but anyways, I just think it's interesting to continue that progression of presidents into the continued flip-flop.
So because money becomes so much the engine of the ship, let's say, that's pushing this forward, and it's coming at such a speed and with such, one might almost call it ferocity, especially as the Soviets get first nuclear weapons and then thermonuclear weapons. And so there's this whole worry, and then the space race and all the rest. Everything kind of seems to be escalating. And so there's this sense that this hidden cultural side of things, you might think, oh my God, who cares? It was about nuclear weapons and space. But I mean, it really is kind of getting into the minds and just the very basic assumptions as to how we deal with the world around us, how we deal with human systems, how we deal with human urban spaces, what is culture, and so on and so forth. What is it to be an American human as opposed to a Soviet human, as opposed to a Chinese human, you know? All of these things were the fight.
Yes, but also, like you said before, follow the money. What else was happening as all this evolved? The art market, the contemporary art market in particular, started to evolve. So, you know, the auction market is for art is the most unregulated market in the world. Like, things that are illegal to do in normal trading are perfectly legal in the art market. So, for example, if I'm a big collector and I'm collecting an artist, if I'm a branded collector, if I'm a well-known collector, if I buy a no-name artist, that artist's price is going to skyrocket overnight, right? But then if that artist makes me angry and I'm like, screw you, I'm going to sell his work and his prices are going to dump overnight. However, I can tell all my friends to sell their paintings first before I sell him off. And that's perfectly legal in the art market. That is not legal in stock trading, right? And that's not the only exception.
I think it's inevitable that with this commercialization and the prices start to go up. I mean, I think today, most people who are not art people, and, you know, it's not that large a group of people, partly because, hey, to be a real collector, you know, this stuff is expensive. The press doesn't say, hey, wow, this painter just kind of changed up their style. Isn't that interesting? We're gonna do a whole, you know, two-page spread on this in our magazine or our blog or our newspaper or whatever. No, it's this painting sold for this much money at auction. It's all about money, money, money.
It's a brand.
Everything has become this brand.
So what abstract expressionism and particularly modern art did is it separated technique from art. So now, if you think about music, you know, we expect our musicians to play in tune, to play on the right beats, you know, to make something more or less that we like to listen to, right? And that requires a lot of skill and technique. But imagine that same band playing off tempo, singing out of tune, and telling you, oh, it's just art. And if you don't get it, then you're dumb. And that's what's happened in the contemporary art market. Like, anybody can paint a white canvas. Anybody can draw a circle on canvas. The difference between maybe you and I making a circle on canvas and the artist that circle on canvas goes for millions of dollars, or Cy Twombly painting, you know, with the scribbles, literal pencil scribbles, is that he's branded and he's marketed himself and he's been collected by branded collectors like Saatchi. He's been sold in branded galleries. You know, there's major branded galleries like White Cube, et cetera. And he's been branded by auction houses like Christie's and Sotheby's, right? And all those brandings tell the hedge funds, who, by the way, buy this art and put it in storage and you can own like a percentage of it if you want. All those things tell the hedge fund people, okay, this is worth more money because of these brands. But nobody can go and look at that and tell the difference. In fact, the British love putting art experts, you know, on a show with kids' drawings and high-end art that's supposed to be worth millions, and they get caught every time, right? Like, because there is no skill difference.
Right. Right, because I don't know what makes it. Before we started talking, you and I were just chit-chatting, and you know, that's kind of what happened with Andy Warhol. Andy Warhol saw this commodification and commercialization. He himself was a commercial artist and a very good one. He had fine art aspirations, I think, and he was told, not so much. Once you stick to the commercial art. So he was like, oh, okay, soup can. How do you like that? And is it good or is it not? You don't know. But because I decided that fame is part of it, clearly from the way that you price things, I'm going to become so famous that I can sign a toilet. I mean, granted, somebody, I think Duchamp did that way back when, it's the same critique, you know, 50, 40 years later. If these people, these self-appointed guardians of the culture, decide that it's art, then it's art.
Yes, and that is the world we are currently living in.
Right, except that because the CIA, who started off with this externally focused thing. It was Europe was the battleground. This is countering the communists. But then, of course, especially with McCarthy, it's like, oh, but you know, we might have fellow travelers here as well, and the money thing, and then you get commercial art involved, and it all becomes this, like, the outside comes inside, and you get this kind of blurry thing.
Mm-hmm.
So that, and I think it's unfortunate, because for many people today, we are all consumers of some form of art or another, but the fine art world feels very remote and very out of touch. We can go to watch something on Netflix.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, I watch something on Netflix and I can critique it because I watch so many things on Netflix that I feel like I'm a professional critic.
Sure, you're a connoisseur of content. If you ask anybody down the street, name three movie stars, almost anybody can name three movie stars that are alive today. If you ask anybody off the street, name three living contemporary artists, almost nobody can, because that's how far removed from the actual interaction with everyday people the high-end art market has become. They are so isolated that they don't even have an impact on the culture. It is a high-level, excuse the term, circle jerk, that it is a closed circuit of elites, of, you know, museum board members that still have some of the plants that were originally put there by the CIA 50 years ago in some cases, and, you know, foundations, and all those wealthy people who are so invested, literally invested with millions and millions and millions of dollars in these artworks, that if anybody agreed, okay, maybe that isn't worth money, they would lose out on so much, right? So they have such a high invested interest in maintaining that closed circuit that they have at the top. But it's not meaning anything to anybody. Do you know the artist that had more impact than any other artist in the 20th century, arguably, was Thomas Kincaid? You've seen his work in the malls in the 90s, you know, all those like little cottages with the lights and things going up it, you know, like little pathways and winter, you know, scenes, very cozy and comfortable. But he was traded publicly for billions, that's with a B, of dollars, because so many people were buying and supporting his artwork and loved his artwork because it meant something to them. Now, you can argue, maybe it's too saccharine. I mean, his works make my teeth hurt a little bit when I look at them.
Yeah, saccharine's pretty good. Yeah, I'm not a fan. It's very twee and it's very mall. Like you said, malls. It's good for malls. It's good for a bank, maybe. A quirky bank.
Well, and lots of people's homes and even prints, you know, but I can't deny that when I see it, I feel a little warmth in my heart, even as sweet and saccharine as they are. Like, oh, that looks cozy, right? There's like a little bit of joy that gets through my, you know, sarcasm or my, is it real art or not? And also Thomas Kincaid had the vestiges of classical training because he was in California with artists that had the atelier training that he got in his youth. So he had the skills to create the message that he intended. He didn't have to default to a circle on canvas because he didn't have any other skills. He created art that resonated with millions and millions of people that people around the world can recognize. And he was traded for billions of dollars. So by every measure of what Americans think art, is it financially successful? Do people like it? Can people recognize it? He was arguably, in my opinion, the most successful painter of the 20th century.
Like it or lump it. The bank balance says he's the winner.
Yes, right. But the point is that his work meant something to a lot of people and affected their lives in a way that almost no quote unquote contemporary art does today, because it's so isolated in a closed circuit away from public, and because it's divorced from technique, right? There's nothing to say that my scribbles versus Cy Twombly's scribbles are superior or inferior other than all these brands that it's collected along the way.
So like the old joke goes, I don't know if it's art, but I like it. Well, yes and no. For most of us, art seems very distant. That's something that our betters, the rich people, talk about and spend money on and have arguments over and things like this, while the rest of us are just down here watching Netflix and eating candy. One of the reasons that we live in that kind of an art-poor world, if you will, is because art has become so commodified and commercialized, and not entirely because of the CIA's efforts, but in large part because of the CIA's efforts in promoting a particular art style that arose sort of spontaneously, abstract expressionism. Their efforts to promote that abroad and at home as the ultimate American art style completely different from anything else. And the vast amounts of money that they dumped into these efforts helped make the modern art world that seems so very, very far away for most of us. My guest today has been Mandy Tice. She is the founder and director of the School of Atelier Arts and the academic director and a professor at Florence Academy of Art in Italy. And we have been talking about the CIA, the arts, and the Cold War, and how that all came about, and some of the repercussions that we are still living with today. Obviously, because you're all about realistic art forms, obviously abstract art kind of sticks in your craw. You don't like it.
Yeah, well, I'm not anti it. I'm just pro the truth about it. That's all. And, you know, there's actually, you know, contemporary artworks that I really enjoy that communicate just with the arts, you know, but they don't need like a thesis next to them in order for me to understand what they are. Because to me, that might be illustration with a, you know, writing sample, but that, to me, that's not art. But there is, you know, contemporary art that communicates its intent visually to me, and I find that really powerful as well. It's just, you know, from my point of view, realism is continuously villainized, even in art schools today. It's very common by the time people end up in my school. So I teach realism classes online, and they'll tell me, oh, my art teacher told me the figure was dead, right? Or my art teacher told me I wasn't making real art. You know, so it's still, realism is under attack constantly from this ideology that is like 50 years old, right? And I just believe that people should be making the artwork that's in their head and their hearts without compromise. And in order to not compromise, you need to have skills. That being said, if you're interested in learning skills, I teach people how to draw and paint online through the School of Atelier Arts. We offer workshops and ongoing classes. If you're not sure if atelier training is what you're looking for, you can take a free quiz that we have on our schoolofatelierarts.com homepage. And I also have a free color class. So if you want to try dabbling in atelier training, I have this free color class that you can take again at the schoolofatelierarts.com. It's on our homepage there. And you can kind of try it out and see what you think of atelier training.
And you can find a link to that website in the episode notes below as well. If freedom is choice, as I genuinely believe it is, eliminating the choice to do realistic and figurative art really seems like we're limiting people's choices, and thus, by definition, their freedoms.
Yes. And also, I think beauty is so underrated. You know, beauty has become a villainous term, you know, for the last 50 years. Like, oh, it's not real art if it's beautiful. But beauty is, you know, for many, many years, at least in the Western canon, has been aspired to. It was believed that it made you a better person. It brought more joy into your life. It, you know, improved your outlook. It would make you happier. Like, why wouldn't we want beauty in our lives? And I think it's time we stop villainizing beauty and recognize that a lot of the beauty that we can appreciate, you know, in museums or in buildings, it comes from skill and technique, and that maybe it's time we stopped eschewing those things in our lives.
Excellent. I couldn't have said that better myself. Thank you again to my guest, Mandy Tice, for talking to me, and of course, everybody out there for listening to this episode of Conspiracy Clearinghouse. Thank you for visiting the Conspiracy Clearinghouse. We're closing now, but we'll open another crate in the next episode. Until then, thank you for listening.